It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The job market in Iowa is strong right now, but some fields are much stronger than others. This hour, we continue our summer series, Iowa at Work, with a conversation about Iowa's hot jobs. We'll meet people working in some of those hot jobs and find out about how students and job seekers can prepare to get the jobs they want. But first, let's find out what the hot jobs are. Ed Wallace is Deputy Director of Iowa Workforce Development. He's with us today. Hello, Ed.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Iowa has a relatively low unemployment rate, 3.8% right now. What does that mean for Iowa?
Well, truly, it means there's a lot of opportunity across a number of industry sectors in all quadrants of the state. And we've got a lot of openings for business and finance, computer and IT, the life sciences and the like, a tremendous opportunity across the great state if we have the workers that have the skills to meet those needs.
And when we hear 3.8%, that sounds pretty good, especially compared to some of the numbers that we hear in other states around the nation. But it's also, that's pretty close to full employment, right? Because workers are always in flux.
That's right. But 3.5% is considered full employment, technically. 3.8%, we're at the lowest unemployment we've had here in Iowa since 2008. We've got about 1.6 million workers across the great state of Iowa and really could use more for all the different openings that we have all over.
Now, you put out a report on hot jobs in Iowa every other year. What makes something qualify as a hot job?
Truly, it's where we see a high growth. We see annual growth rates above 2.5%, and some of the areas we see growth rates of 4.85%, and those are typically the jobs that have a technology component to it, have a language component to it, and quite frankly, are in an emerging industry, and we've got a number of emerging industries here in Iowa.
Can you give me some concrete examples of some of those jobs that are on the top of the list?
Absolutely. We've got a number of biotechnology positions that fall into the life science area, and that's truly a growth agent for the state of Iowa. Additionally, as we all know, education has been a staple for Iowa, and we've got a number of elementary, post-secondary, and secondary positions that are open. We've always been the food capital of the world, and food continues to be a steady growth, particularly food production and value-added agriculture as it pertains to food production. So those are typically the ones that we see. Agriculture continues to remain strong. Some of the positions, however, that have an analytical component to it, as people that can manipulate big data, those are the positions that are in very, very great demand.
All right, and we're going to talk to an actuary here in a couple of minutes. I'm guessing that's one of those jobs that falls into that category.
Absolutely. Without question, actuaries are very high on the list, along with market research analysts and marketing specialty folks. The other thing I should note is that information security analysts, as we move to the Internet on most everything that we do, we've got to have more and more folks that can do the security component as it relates to that type of technology.
When you look at, we've talked about sort of fields and sectors, but when you look at that list and you look at some of the jobs that fall into those fields, are there any jobs that kind of stand out as something that, you know what, people actually don't know what this person does, but you could get a job pretty easily if you prepared for it?
Well, one that's kind of interesting is medical equipment repair. That's always one that, how do you become a medical equipment repair person? And that's where we've got high growth. As we continue to have our population age, a lot of our older Iowans are continuing to live longer and have more robust life activity in the later years. And to be able to have the requisite equipment, we need people that can repair that. And as always, we have personal care aides and home care aides that we need. So that's something that you give strong consideration to.
All right, Ed, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Ed Wallace is Deputy Director of Iowa Workforce Development. We've talked about some of these fields that are growing in Iowa. Now we're going to talk to people who are doing jobs in those fields. Next up, Michael Schulten is here. He's an actuary and CFO of Principal Management Corporation, a division of the Principal Financial Group. Hello, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And when I say actuary, a lot of people say, oh, so tell us, what does an actuary do?
Yeah, that's a question I get a lot, too, when you explain what you do. So The best way to explain what an actuary is you take math in one hand and business in the other hand, and you kind of smash them together, and an actuary tends to be one of the roles that falls out. When people think of an actuary, it's about analyzing risk is where you're usually employed. And so life insurance companies like Principal Financial Group are a place where actuaries are typically employed. Now, when people hear actuary, they usually think about life expectancy, and actuaries are usually the ones that are, a joke is, they can predict when you're going to die based on your gender and age and smoking status. So when you buy a life insurance policy and you have to pay your premium, it's the actuary that's the one typically in that back room figuring out your premiums and what you have to pay.
So how did you decide you wanted to be an actuary?
Yeah, when I was in high school, I loved math, was good at math, and was trying to find some math-related fields. And my mom's boss actually brought actuarial science to my attention. And I looked it up at the time, so this would have been the late 90s, and it was rated the number two job to have in America, I think behind marine biology. And I knew I wanted to go to the University of Iowa, and at the time, Iowa was ranked the number one actuarial college in the nation. So it kind of fit together, and I started with that as my major and ended up with a career.
So this came out of a love of math for you. On a day-to-day basis, what do you do?
Yeah, so you do take a lot of big data. I heard you mention that with your previous guest. There is a lot of data that you can analyze and put together. I like to say that a good actuary can take a lot of data and turn it into information that is then used by executives at your company to make decisions. But the actuarial role has really evolved. I've been fortunate at my career at Principal where I've been able to take my actuarial degree and do some different types of roles. And so I think that the actuarial role can do a lot of things. You can, again, you're good at math, you're good at business, you can be good at company strategy. And we've had a lot of successful people at the Principal Financial Group come up from an actuarial background. Our current CEO and CFO both have actuarial backgrounds.
Well, and you graduated from college in 2001, right?
That's correct.
So in the last 14 years, you've had a pretty exceptional career path, a lot of growth for you.
Well, that's kind of you to say. Yeah, thank you.
But can you give us a little outline of what you've progressed through over the last 14 years?
Yeah, so I started off, as I mentioned, pricing life insurance plans. That was kind of my first role at Principal. And then I moved into working in our retirement area, so think 401ks or pension plans, working on that type of work. And then I took a jump and did a non-traditional role where I worked in our investor relations area. So I met with shareholders and prospective shareholders of the Principal Financial Group and tried to explain why they should invest their money with us. And now I've moved into our mutual fund division, so I lead a financial reporting team in that area of our company. And again, I think that's a great example of how actuaries can use their skill set in a lot of different roles in a lot of different companies. And as it pertains to Iowa, this is a great place to get this role because you have Principal where I work, but you have a bunch of other insurance companies here. This is really the insurance capital of the U.S., in my opinion. So this is a great city and a great state to do this, and there are a lot of colleges in the area that do have actuarial backgrounds. I went to Iowa, but Drake has a very strong program, UNI, and even a lot of the smaller colleges are starting to do a little bit with actuarial science. Maybe they don't have the major, but you can specialize in some stuff. So places like Simpson and Grinnell and colleges like that are starting to do it as well.
And what do you have to do to become a certified actuary?
Yeah, there is a series of exams. So it's around eight, nine exams right now. So people know about the CPA exam to become an accountant or the bar exam to become a lawyer. So there are a series of exams to become an actuary. And it's not fun, I'll be honest, but you do learn a lot, and it does train you for doing the role in the future.
And can you go through all of those exams with a bachelor's degree, or do you have to pursue graduate work?
Nope, I only have a bachelor's degree, so you can definitely do it.
It sounds like when you describe how you decided to pursue actuary science that it was a pretty practical decision for you. Would you say that's true? It was based on, oh, here's something I can do and I can get a job in this field?
Yeah. I was looking at a math-related field. I didn't want to be a teacher. That wasn't for me. So you kind of have accounting, engineering, and then actuarial science are three roles that, you know, math-inclined people can do that. So another nice thing about this is when I was at Iowa, the companies really came and found me. I didn't have to really apply for any jobs, do any research on my own. the companies all came to Iowa and met with myself and my classmates at Iowa and you interviewed for jobs. So that was very nice when a lot of my friends and other majors were trying to find jobs on the internet, do a lot of research by themselves. You know, the companies really came out and found us, and that was very nice.
Well, and a lot of students, we've talked about that during this series on Iowa at Work, a lot of students go through sort of this searching period where they're trying to figure out what they're passionate about, what they care about, and what they could do as a career. Were your friends a little jealous that you seemed to know where you were headed?
Yeah, you know, I had accepted a job early in my senior year. I think that was right. Another thing I'd mention is internships are a great way. So I had an internship at Principal after my sophomore year in college. I interned for a company in the suburbs of Chicago after my junior year. So that was a great leg up to get some exposure to see if that was something I really wanted to do long term, and then also to give companies exposure to me. And that really helped, I think, with getting a job as well.
Do you recommend to young people that actuarial science is an area of field that they should look into?
Yeah, if people like math and people like business and or econ, finance, kind of roll that all up into one, this is a great profession. I would highly recommend getting an internship or doing a job shadow. Again, there's a lot of great colleges in the area that allow you to do that, and a lot of great companies in Iowa. You don't even have to leave the state to be able to get a great position.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for talking with us today.
I had a great time. Thanks.
Michael Scholten is an actuary and CFO of Principal Management Corporation, a division of the Principal Financial Group. This hour, we're continuing our summer series, Iowa at Work, with a conversation about Iowa's job market. So we're talking about some of Iowa's hot jobs. In just a moment, we're going to meet a physician assistant. We're also going to meet a welder. We'll talk about an externship program as well, as we're preparing our students to enter these fields. Of course, teachers need to understand what kind of skills their students need. So we'll find out about an externship program that gives teachers the kind of real-world experience that they can bring into the classroom and share with their students. That's coming up a little later on this hour. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're continuing our summer series, Iowa at Work. This hour, we're talking about Iowa's job market. Coming up at noon today on River to River, we'll talk about the wage gap. Right now, we're exploring some of Iowa's hottest jobs. We just met an actuary a few minutes ago. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll meet a welder. But right now, with me is David Asprey. He's a physician assistant. He's also chair of the Department of Physician Assistant Studies and Services in the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Dave, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Now, I know that a lot of us have seen physician assistants, but tell us again, what does a physician assistant do?
Yeah, in a nutshell, really, physician assistants are trained to deliver medical care, and they are nationally certified as well as being licensed in the state, and really very similar to what physicians do in their practice in terms of being able to see the patient, collect the history, do the physical examination, diagnose problems, and prescribe treatments.
All right. And I know a lot of us have been very grateful to have a physician assistant to see because often you can get an appointment easier and there's a lot of accessibility. But what is the difference between how you prepare to be a physician assistant and how you prepare to be a doctor?
Yeah, certainly there are a number of individuals, I think, as they come out of school, maybe thinking about health professions in general. And quite often there is that decision between being a physician, being a physician assistant, perhaps some other health professions that they might be considering. By and large, I think we're seeing today that a lot of people really are attracted to the physician assistant role in that it is a shorter time in training. As mentioned, really, I think there's tremendous overlap in what the two professions do in many cases, depending on the exact specialty that they practice in. But for most physician assistants, I think finding an opportunity where they can get into practice after basically completing a bachelor's degree, an additional 25 to 28 months in their master's degree to become a physician assistant, and then into practice. And along with that, one of the features that it seems to be really attractive to a lot of applicants today is the ability to change specialties. So I've worked in pediatric cardiology. I've also worked in emergency medicine. And as a physician, you would need to go back and go through a residency in order to make that change. And so that's been one of the really attractive features, I think, of the
and
profession.
As a physician assistant, how do you change those specialties? What kind of preparation do you need?
Yeah. So interestingly, PAs are trained very generally when they're going through their training. And so from that perspective, they have a lot of background in broadly trained in terms of primary care-oriented activities. For PAs who choose to go into a specialty, there usually is a period of time where they will be more closely monitored perhaps or work more closely with the physician that they are being supervised by. As they continue to gain knowledge and expertise in that area, they get greater responsibility, greater autonomy. So it's similar to being like a resident or an intern who goes through a period of time where as you work in that specialty, if you've not worked in it previously, you may check in with your supervising physician a little more frequently. And as you gain the expertise and knowledge and get the feedback from your physician, you may practice with a very, very high degree of autonomy as you continue to develop your skills.
Now, a lot of us have encountered PAs in like quick care type settings, the kind of thing where you don't need to make an appointment. You just stop in and you get to see somebody. Can you give me an idea of the broad array of settings that physician assistants can work in?
Yeah, great question. There certainly has been a lot of change, I think, in the profession over the years. Early on, I think we found that PAs were really being brought into the system to fill in gaps, if you will, where physicians maybe were maldistributed. It was difficult to perhaps keep a physician in a small rural community. And so a lot of them went into primary care because that was the greatest area of need. As the profession has continued to develop and as well, healthcare has been changing immensely. We've seen that they are oftentimes a group of healthcare providers who can fill in fairly quickly because of their ability to change specialties into the greatest areas of need. So we see a lot of them in quick care settings. Orthopedics seems to be an area that they are frequently being sought after right now. Emergency medicine in the traditional sense as well as in urgent care settings is also very popular right now. But PAs are also being looked at to fill in some cases where residency hours for physicians has been carefully monitored in recent years, and so many hospitals are also looking at PAs as a group of providers who can also help fill in the gap sometimes where they can't have all the resident coverage that they would like to have. And so working as a hospitalist or taking care of patients in an inpatient setting is also an area that PAs have filled in a very important niche.
I understand that as far as preparation goes, I know medical school is an incredible commitment of resources and of time, and it's also incredibly challenging. So I can see the advantage to becoming a PA as far as that goes. But what are some of, in your perspective, some of the other advantages that PAs might have even over physicians?
Quite often what we see is that PAs are being selected based on previous healthcare experience. So for many of our students that are being selected and chosen to be a PA today, they've worked in the healthcare setting in some capacity. It might be as a nursing assistant, might be as an emergency medicine technician, any number of areas where they get some direct patient contact. So quite often the individuals who are selected for PA programs do have some previous real-life healthcare experience that oftentimes gives them, I think, a unique perspective. Perhaps gives them the ability to really have developed some skills in establishing rapport with patients, being able to make those connections quite quickly and do some of the skills that are really important and foundational to the role of a good clinician.
Does it also give you more flexibility as far as hours go?
Certainly in some cases, I think, if you compared physicians in particular to the PA schedules, quite often there will be some advantages to the role of the PA in terms of flexibility. Quite often the physician assistant may not be involved in the business aspect of all of the practices. In some cases they are, but certainly I think it gives the opportunity for individuals to choose a career that meets the lifestyle that they're really interested in. Interestingly enough, about 70% of all applicants to PA programs across the country right now are female. Hmm. And as we interact with individuals who are applying, certainly lifestyle issues are one of the factors I think that influences that decision.
Okay, so women who want to have a little more control over the hours that they work and be more available for family needs, that kind of thing.
That's one of the reasons that we certainly hear from the applicants, yes.
It also sounds, as you describe what physician assistants do, I have heard doctors over the years complain about, well, I became a doctor, but I don't spend as much time taking care of patients as I thought I would. It sounds like that's what physician assistants do.
Yeah, very true. Quite often, I think some of the more time-consuming tasks, including, activities like patient education or preparing them to avoid diseases, so disease prevention, Many of those activities, you know, will oftentimes be something that the physician assistant spends a fair amount of time doing, freeing up the physician on the team that they're working with to do some of those particular activities that really require their absolute direct involvement. So in many respects, I think the PAs do find themselves being sort of that front line, interacting with the patients most directly and really providing that direct care and perhaps a little less involved in some of the administrative duties that can sometimes go along with those positions.
Now, we've seen the need for physician assistants grow a great deal. Are you also seeing a growth in interest among students?
Yes, absolutely. We get a lot of contacts. You know, it used to be many years ago, we quite often were not contacted until sort of a afterthought or a second consideration.
Maybe I don't want to do this after all.
Right.
Maybe I could do that.
And so now what we're seeing is that high school students seem to know about the profession. So they're oftentimes planning and preparing, picking up CNA, certified nursing assistant jobs or other activities to give them the healthcare experience that they would like to get to be a competitive applicant. And so there definitely is increasing interest. You know, the growth has been dramatic. At the University of Iowa last year, we had about 800 applicants for the 25 spots. So it's amazingly popular in that respect.
Okay, so it's not hard to get a job, but it may be hard to get the education.
To a degree, although, again, now there's a centralized application service, and so individuals can click on a box and apply to as many programs as they want. So it's not quite as competitive as those numbers sound. There's about 3 applicants for every position that exists across the country.
All right. It's clearly a field that's growing by leaps and bounds. Dave, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
David Asprey is a physician assistant. He's also chair of the Department of Physician Assistant Studies and Services in the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. We're talking about some of Iowa's hot jobs right now. So we've already met an actuary and a physician assistant, and now Jeff Mitchell is here. He is a welder. He's also dean of industrial technology at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids and was recently named National Welding Educator of the Year. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yes.
Now, Jeff, how did you become a welder?
I started way back in high school, an opportunity that has changed over the years for high school students. But I took my first welding class at 16 and had my first production welding job at 17 while still attending high school.
What drew you into the field?
I was always fascinated just by the visual image of welding. I mean, it's the only time in my life I've seen what I consider pure energy. And so I was always fascinated since I was 5 years old.
So because it was cool.
It was cool, yes. Yes.
Now, welding has changed dramatically during your career. Can you help us understand what welding was then and what welding is now?
Yes. When I got into welding, the equipment was fairly basic. You had 2 controls on the machine, and that was the extent of the adjustments that you had. But nowadays, with the advent of inverter technology and stuff that came out in the mid-90s, a typical welder could have 10 controls on it now. And you really have to understand the capability of the technology to maximize the weld quality. And also, we're now getting into robots that are producing repetitive welds. So the manual welding is more short run type of situations versus the robotics.
Now, I can see where a lot of people would be drawn to welding the way you were drawn to welding. Blowtorches are cool. And,
yes.
And you can have a lot of fun. But it sounds like you need to have a much stronger technology background to be able to do the job today.
Yes, and another aspect of it is back in the 70s and prior to that, energy was very cheap back then, and so weight and stuff of the transportation industry and aeronautics industry was not as big of a factor as it is today. And so to lighten the materials up, they had to go to higher and higher strength, high alloy aluminums and stainless steels and steels. And all of a sudden, the heat and stuff that is put into a material from the welding process had to be controlled to a much better extent than it had to in the past. So all of a sudden, you had to start to learn the science of welding, not just the art of welding.
So if somebody today says, I want to become a welder, what kind of education do they need?
You can get job entry skills depending on the welding process. You can have short-term training of 150 hours and get a good production welding, MIG welding job. And you need more training if you want to get into a couple other welding processes. or you can go up to a 2-year degree. You can go up to a 4-year degree. You can get a PhD in it from Ohio State University. So there's really no end. And what happens is as you go up the scale, you get more and more into the weld quality, the metallurgy, the welding inspection aspects of the welding industry.
So you, of course, work at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids. What kind of programs do you offer for people who want to get into welding?
We actually offer several. We have both the non-credit side of the college that offers the short-term training for welding. Then on the credit side of the college, we have long-term 1-year diploma, 2-year degrees, and then we also have what we call K-PACE welding for the underemployed and unemployed. And then we have contracted training welding where we go out into business and industry and upgrade the knowledge and skills of the existing workforce.
Is there – do you feel like there's a strong awareness among people who are looking to get into the field of what's possible?
No, I really don't. I think one thing that will open the eyes of many people that for the last 4 to 5 years on any given day, there's been between 400 and 500 job openings in the welding field in the state of Iowa that go unfilled because of lack of skills.
Wow. Now, when I think about welding, I think of it as a very physical job. It sounds like that may not be as important a factor. What do you think?
It has become less so. There's still some aspects of the welding industry that tend to be that way, but there's weld shops in Cedar Rapids that are air-conditioned. There's weld shops that specialize in aluminum components. So there's a lot of variety in welding, especially in eastern Iowa, than you see in many parts of the nation.
So does that give the job more longevity as well? I mean, as a person ages, a physical job can become difficult to do.
Absolutely, yes. It definitely will extend the career of a person when they're working in that type of more worker-friendly environment.
Now, I want to move beyond welding to talk about the field of industrial technology because it's not just welding that has changed so dramatically. Can you give me an idea of some of the jobs that you're preparing students for?
Yes, actually, in the industrial technologies department at Kirkwood, we offer what we call we have 20 programs, and they fall into 4 career clusters. One is the energy cluster. Another one is transportation, and then the advanced manufacturing career cluster, and then architecture construction. And all of our graduates, there's multiple job opportunities for them. We struggle with developing a pipeline into our programs that will meet the needs of today's workforce.
All right, and what do you mean by that? Where are you looking for students?
One thing that we have done is we have 4 regional centers now where high school students can get dual credit. We have one in Monticello and Hiawatha and just a new one opening on Oakdale campus and then one in Washington, Iowa. We want to expose them to careers in the 11th and 12th grade because that has lessened over the years in the high school system for many reasons. And so we are addressing that in partnership with many, many school districts in our area.
So when you say advanced manufacturing, give me some concrete examples of jobs in that field.
CNC machinists, industrial maintenance, automation, instrumentation, telecommunications, electronics engineering, CAD mechanical engineering, welding falls within that career.
When I was growing up and there was, you know, there was the track for kids who wanted to go directly into vocations out of high school, and then there was the track for kids who wanted to go to college. That track for kids who wanted to go into vocations, it seemed like there were fewer options than the ones you just described. It sounds
yes.
Like this has just exploded. Manufacturing must be very different than it once was.
It is. And, you know, I think the public has a perception of blue-collar job and white-collar jobs, but there's a fast emerging what I call gold-collar jobs, and that is the jobs that you use both your hands and your mind equally. And that's what you see because you'll have a CNC machinist that will sit down in front of a computer and write a program for 2 or 3 hours and then go out and download it into a piece of equipment and turn out 1,000 parts off that. So,
Well, Jeff, we're going to take a little break. I'd like you to stay with us as we go on this hour. Jeff Mitchell is a welder. He's also Dean of Industrial Technology at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids. He was recently named National Welding Educator of the Year. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk about an externship program. This is for teachers who are trying to introduce their students into different STEM fields to give teachers real-world job experience that they can bring with them into the classroom. We'd also love to hear from you. If you have questions today, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we continue our summer series, Iowa at Work. We're talking about some of the hottest jobs in Iowa. And in recent years, there's been a lot of emphasis on STEM in early education. STEM, of course, stands for science, technology, engineering, and math, but there still seems to be a disconnect between studying those subjects and preparing for the job market. An externship can help teachers bridge that gap where a K through 12 teacher works in one of the fields he or she is preparing students for. And with me today, Jeff Weld. He is executive director of the Governor's STEM Council. He's also founder of the Real World Externship Program. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
Thank you. So I'm so glad you could join us today.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity.
Megan Reynolds is also with us. She's a program supervisor for the Real World Externship Program. She also teaches science at Cedar Falls High School. Hello, Megan.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff, as the founder of this program, tell me what the inspiration was. What is the goal of this program?
Yeah, there were two drivers to this program, which launched in 2009. One was there's a common program across Iowa and across the nation called Research Experiences for Teachers. There's a pretty standard fare that universities, including UNI at that time, were bringing teachers into campus to work shoulder to shoulder with scientists, researchers over the course of summer. And at the end of each summer, I would debrief the teachers and say, what could we do to improve this program? And many times, these teachers, adults, citizens, parents would say, well, it's all great, but staying in the dorms and away from my family is a real hardship. If only I could do this in my hometown. And at the same time, there was this emerging chasm between the worlds of business and education, this cultural chasm that we thought could be filled with these bridge builders, teachers who we would prepare to enter the workforce world, the industry and business culture. And so those were the two central drivers, and enough businesses stepped forward in those early days, including Oh Dear and MidAmerican, Hy-Vee, Principal Financial, Acumold, Civco, Kemen, the Hygienic Lab, Diamond Vogel, Monsanto, Vermeer, many more, and a program was born.
Now, this has been going on since 2009. Can you give me a rough idea of how many teachers have been able to participate in it?
Yeah, we're into the 200s. We can manage about 50 per summer, and we've built gradually up to that capacity. But current funding streams and staffing, as Megan well knows, keep us in the 50s each summer.
All right. And Megan, maybe you can give me an idea as a program supervisor. How does this work? If a teacher says, hey, I want to be part of this program, what's the process?
Well, it's really a delicate balance of finding a teacher and their skills, their specialized content area, and then the local business, like Jeff said, and just making that match of what the business is looking for and what the teacher can do for that business.
All right. And, of course, it needs to be worth it to the business. It also needs to be worth it to the teacher. Is this something that teachers get paid to do?
Yes, they do. Teachers can earn for the 5 to 6 weeks. It's a maximum of 30 days. They can earn up to $4,800, and that's funded partially by the host business and partially by the Governor's STEM Advisory Council.
And 5 or 6 weeks, that's not a lot of time, but of course that's most of the summer break.
Yes.
For teachers. How do teachers get up to speed in that period of time?
Well, teachers are, not that I'm biased, but teachers are fairly incredible and very quick learners. So there's definitely a learning curve, but our hosts are very gracious, and they will spend some time in the beginning, showing the teacher the ropes of the business. But really, the teachers just jump in. Our teachers are very autonomous, and once you send them in a direction, they'll go.
All right, and we're going to meet a teacher who's in the midst of one of these externship programs right now. But Jeff, before I let you go, can you give me an idea of some of the other statewide efforts in this area of skills development, workforce development, trying to get people to fill that pipeline we were talking about earlier for these technical jobs that don't necessarily require a college degree?
Oh, right. In addition to externships, there's a variety of strategies rolling out over the last 4 years under the umbrella of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council. It's essentially an entirely public-private partnership so that every program that's delivered to the schools comes with an expectation of a mentorship or a job shadow or a guest speaker, some other kind of a connection with the world of industry. We're also expanding a series of school business partners called STEM Best. Best is another acronym, standing for Businesses Engaging Students and Teachers. There's 6 sites across the state currently operating, bridging these cultures, as it were, and we'll probably launch another 6 in the coming year. We've got a public awareness campaign operating right now that portrays kids in exciting skilled trades and across the state in advanced manufacturing, information technology, ag science, finance. So it's an all-hands-on-deck endeavor to try and convince the kids today, as well as communities, parents, stakeholders, that STEM education is going to lead to some really great workforce career trajectories.
Well, and as we were talking about earlier, there seems to be sort of a lack of awareness. Okay, I kind of like these STEM subjects, but what can I do with them? Is there also a push just to make sure people know what the jobs are?
Yeah, I think you're just drilling into a really interesting point in history here in Iowa, and of course across the United States, everybody's grappling with this, and it is the two cultures are evolving at different rates, right? The world of business and industry is incredibly innovative. They have to be, a globally competitive environment in which they dwell. Our education systems aren't evolving at the same rate, so we have this inevitable disconnect between the jobs of the 21st century and we teachers and how we can stay dialed in to these rapidly evolving professions that didn't exist when we were in college and that we've got to stay attuned to. And that, I think, is part of the magic of externships, getting our teachers up to speed, as it were, with what's happening in the world of work.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for calling in today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeff Weld is executive director of the Governor's STEM Council. He's also founder of the Real World Externship Program. And Megan, before we bring Kayla Brower into the conversation, she's in the midst of an externship program right now, but you took a different route into education than many people. You actually started in industry and then became a teacher.
I did. So I kind of have a real world externship, I guess. Graduated from UNI and worked in environmental testing and research labs. And so I know firsthand how valuable it is now that I've been in the classroom to draw upon those experiences. And the interest it piques with the students, you know, you can teach a titration and say, hey, this is what you can do with it. You know, you can test for ammonia and wastewater, and you know, bringing that content applicability into the classroom just makes a huge difference with the students.
Nice. I want to bring Kayla into the conversation now. As I mentioned, Kayla Brower is in the midst of an externship right now. She's an eighth grade teacher in Johnston, just finished her first year of teaching. Hello, Kayla. Hi, Kayla.
Hi.
You are doing an externship right now. Can you describe for me what you're doing?
Sure. I'm actually almost in my last week at Kemen Industries, and I'm in the Kemen Health Business Department, and I actually have a biology endorsement, so working in chemistry is something completely new for me. But we're working on a lot of product testing, and I've actually been able to complete a couple of projects almost on my own. So
how many weeks, you said you're almost done, how many weeks have you been there?
I've completed just my 5th week from my last week right now.
All right. And so this must have been kind of an exciting summer for you. What do you think you've learned that you'll be able to take back to your students in the fall?
Oh, I've learned so much. And I don't teach a whole lot of chemistry content, but I've definitely learned more about collaboration skills, communication skills, the ability to be able to jump in and ask questions, a lot of skills outside of just the content. And I think it's really important that when I go to teach a lesson on genetics or weather. I teach the content, but I'm also thinking about what skills am I teaching my students, because that's really what they're going to take away and use, you know, past eighth grade science.
So how, when you're thinking about how you might want to make some changes in your classroom in the fall, do you have some concrete ideas?
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I've been able to be in on a few meetings here at Kemen, and they always start their days with what does success look like for me today? So I plan to implement that with a lot of my group works. What does success look like for us? What are our goals today? Where are we headed? Instead of just, this is the assignment, we have to get it done. So maybe bringing them in that whole picture. Kemen does a really good job of that, of working together. What's my part? Working collaboratively. So I definitely want to take that back to my kids. How can I help them work together versus just working individually to complete tasks?
So in this series where we've been talking about jobs in Iowa, we've been talking about how students are being prepared for the workforce. And one of the things that some people feel is lacking among today's students are the soft skills, the ability to work together, in addition to being able to show up on time and all of those mm-hmm. things. But it sounds like those are the kinds of things that you want to bring back into your classroom, those soft skills.
They are. And if you look at our new standards, which NGSS, Next Generation Standards, have been quite the topic of conversation, but I think that there's more of a focus on the skills versus the content. So obviously the content is very important, but when I think about a lesson, I think about how am I going to use this content to teach the collaboration skills, the communication skills, the problem-solving skills. When I was listening to the PA and the actuary speak, a lot of what they do seems like it relies on their ability to communicate and collaborate and to organize and problem solve.
Interesting. Well, Kayla, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Kayla Brower is a teacher, an eighth grade teacher in Johnston. She is nearly done with her externship program at Kemen Industries in Des Moines. Megan Reynolds is still here. She's program supervisor for the Real World Externship Program. She also teaches science at Cedar Falls High School. And still with us, we have Jeff Mitchell, who's the Dean of Industrial Technology at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids. And Megan, listening to Kayla talk about her experiences, is that something that you're hearing from a lot of teachers, bringing the kind of collaboration skills that they see in the workplace back into their classrooms?
Absolutely. That's one of the top things we hear from our teacher externs. You know, it's just being aware of, you know, we really need to get our students prepared for that and to be able to work together. And also the technology skills. Teachers are seeing those types of skills that our students need to be able to do. And in every work site, it seems it's our teachers are saying, oh my gosh, I have to get my students using Excel because it's used everywhere, and those sort of technology skills as well.
All right. So even beyond the kind of basic science that you're trying to teach the students, just giving them the tools that they may want to use in the workplace eventually.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you ever see teachers leaving education and entering the private sector after these externships?
It's very, very rare. I think we've only had one instance in the 250 or so teachers we've had go through here. Really, more than anything, it you know, just really motivates teachers and it gets them just really excited for the upcoming year. We've actually had teachers that were considering leaving the teaching world, but it just got them so excited that they were ready to go the next year.
All right. Well, stay with us as we finish out the hour. I want to talk about that education factor of making sure that students, but not just students, older people who might want to change careers are aware of the jobs that are available. And I want to go to the phones now. John is on the line in Manchester. And John, earlier we were talking to a physician assistant. You have a job that's in a similar field, right?
That's right, Charity. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist. That's kind of a long title, nurse anesthetist. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I just recently graduated from the University of Iowa. And I just wanted to dovetail off of what your guest was saying, that especially in Iowa, with our aging population, the demand for healthcare providers is continuing to rise. And nurse practitioners and RNs also help to fill that role to be those providers.
So when you were going into this field, I was just talking to somebody who went to nursing school a while back. She said, I went to nursing school because I knew that I would always have a job if I wanted one. Was it a practical choice for you?
It's a very practical choice, and those are very true words. And the beauty of it is you can go in virtually any direction you want. I think most people think of bedside nurses when they think of nursing careers, but that's only a very small piece of the pie. And it is great knowing that people are always going to need healthcare providers and that job security is always going to be there.
And you don't have to become a doctor. You don't have to just become a nurse. There are a lot of fields within this kind of medicine that are available, right?
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And Jeff, that just drives home the point, I think, that a lot of us aren't aware of the possibilities. So when someone who is thinking about a career change, we talked about the difficulty that you have filling that pipeline for students to go into these fields. But if somebody comes to Kirkwood who's contemplating a career change, how do you get started in telling them what the possibilities are?
They need to sit down with an advisor that is aware of the career possibilities, and there's many avenues for them to re-enter education. It can be through short-term training, through the non-credit. They can progress what we call pipelines or entryways into the credit department. And people are sometimes, if they've been out of education for 10 years, they may be apprehensive to go back to school, but it is a pretty smooth transition. I've seen, we call non-traditional students, they tend to be extremely successful in our programs, and they tend to mentor our traditional students that are right out of high school. So we'll have in the same classroom students that are 19 years old and students that are 55 years old. Our average age in industrial technologies is 29 years old.
So you talked earlier about not being able to get enough students. What kind of placement percentages do you have for people who've finish your programs?
Typically 90%, 85-90% in that range, and there may be barriers to employment of for some people that would account for the remaining 10%. And some programs we have 100% placement rate.
And Megan, I'm curious, with your experience teaching, some of the jobs that Jeff has been talking about, of course, do take strong science skills, and there's something you can do with a strong science interest that doesn't necessarily take a master's degree or a PhD. Do you find that your students have access to the kind of information that let them know what jobs are out there?
Well, and that is the key, is just having access to that information. And it's, you don't have to go on to school for 8 years or even four. And that's the key, is just getting our students aware of what their options are, be it a community college. There are, wonderful employment opportunities for students that go that route. And we just want to make sure our students know about it.
And do you feel, we just have a couple seconds left, but is there a stigma for students about the idea of maybe not going to traditional college that turns them off of some of these careers?
There is, and that's what we're trying to fix.
All right, Megan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Megan Reynolds is a program supervisor of the Real World Externship Program. She also teaches science at my alma mater, Cedar Falls High School. Jeff Mitchell, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Jeff Mitchell is a welder. He's also Dean of Industrial Technology at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids. We'll continue our series, Iowa at Work, today at noon on River to River with a look at the wage gap. I'm Charity Nebbie.